Good afternoon. Welcome to the Institute. My name is Judy Barcelo. I'm the Vice President for the Grant and Fellowship Program today, and I'm really delighted to have all of you here. This is an event that has been a long time coming. The book that we're going to be discussing today was funded through a grant to Professor Charles Call. What year was that?
A couple years ago.
Good answer. And we are really delighted to see it in print. We're especially delighted that it's been published by USIP. For those of you who are itching to get a copy, they are for sale outside. And joining us today is a very illustrious panel of internal and external experts on this subject. But before I turn to them and start the conversation, I want to just do a little bit of housekeeping here. First of all, I'd like everybody to turn their phones off. It's not just the ringing that is a problem, it's actually the signals coming in that interferes with the microphone system. You should also know that this event is being recorded, both by USIP, and an audio version of it will appear on our website in due course or shortly in the next couple of days, but we also have the VOA here today. I also wanted to offer some words of introduction here about the subject, which is frankly not a new subject in the sense that I think both the U.S. and our partners worldwide are increasingly preoccupied with the question of how we reconstruct society post-war. And I think there's a growing consensus on some basic points. These aren't necessarily lessons that we've all learned as well as we should have, but one of the basic points, for example, is that societies that have emerged from long, extended periods of violence, either worse between states or within states, often face very major challenges when it comes to putting back together their security systems, their policing systems, and their justice systems. And we also know that those two components in any society are absolutely vital to moving on into a more stable and peaceful stage. We also know that the transition periods that occur between the ending of the sort of formal ending of the period of violence between the warring parties and the reestablishment of government can be a very crucial period during which essential reforms can be introduced. It's a kind of window of opportunity during which ideas can be floated and reforms can be implemented that might be extremely difficult to undertake at a later stage. We also know, thirdly, that the extent to which peace agreements are specific on reforms that should be taken on these in these two sectors of peace and security and justice, to the extent that they are more specific rather than less, this can be a major boon to the transformational process that one hopes occurs in this transitional period. We also know, however, that whatever reforms are implemented are surrounded by controversy often, with a highly politicized process. New political elites who may be entering into the system will want to play a determining role, while other, old elites who may have lost, in the war may struggle against change. So it's an intensely political process. And then finally, we know that international actors of various descriptions can play an absolutely critical role in this transformational period, that transitional period. And they can play both positive and negative roles. And there's much to be learned from looking at the behavior of the international community during this period. And this is where I feel like I should be piping in the music from, Play It Again, Sam. I mean, these are not startling, lessons. But what we do know is that some of the critical actors, for example, in the Iraqi context, have not learned these lessons. That, there are plenty of lessons to be extracted from cases around the world. We're not very good at applying them. Partly, it's also a challenge because every setting is a bit different. And you can take some basic principles, but then you really have to understand the nuances of a particular context. What I think makes this book so useful is that it draws upon some fresh new case studies from eight countries: El Salvador, Haiti, Guatemala, South Africa, Rwanda, Bosnia, Kosovo, and East Timor. And our speakers today are going to be focusing on some lessons that can be extracted from those cases. We're going to start off with Professor Call as our leading speaker. who is the editor of the book. He's currently an assistant professor in the International Peace and Conflict Resolution Program at American University. As I said, he was a grantee of the Institute, and during a period of time was actually a guest scholar while he was working on the book. Much of his knowledge of this comes from extended periods of time spent in the field in a variety of countries around the world, and in the bio that's been distributed out front, you can see all of those places. And he served as a consultant on these issues with the Ford Foundation, the U.S. Justice Department, UNDP, the European Commission, USAID, and others. Chuck will be followed by Colette Rausch, who is one of the chapter authors. She is one of my colleagues here at USIP. She is the deputy director of USIP's law program. She, too, comes out of a background where she's had hands-on experience in dealing with some of these issues. Before she joined USIP, she was with the OSCE mission in Kosovo, and prior to that was actually working for the Department of Justice as a legal advisor in Hungary and Bosnia. I have to add that since then she also was a federal prosecutor in Nevada on white collar crimes and violent crimes, I guess. So if anyone has a guilty conscience, you can slink out the door before she starts to speak. She will be followed then by two discussants. We'll turn next to Ambassador Jacques Klein, who really brings a kind of a unique perspective, having served as the chief of UN operations in three different peacekeeping operations in Croatia, Bosnia-Herzegovina, and Liberia. He's also the former Undersecretary General of the United Nations, who's retired from that position. And then finally, we'll be joined by my colleague, Mike Jidzik, who joined USIP, first of all, our Research and Studies Program, but now is a Senior Program Officer in our Center for Post-Conflict Peace and Stability Operations. He comes out of a 30-year career with the military, with the U.S. Air Force. He taught at the U.S. Air Force Academy. He was a professor at the National War College, a strategic planner for the United Nations mission in Kosovo, and also has a lot of grounded experience in other parts of the world, including El Salvador. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Professor Paul.
Thank you very much, Judy. Thank you all for coming today, and let me just start by thanking lots of people briefly. One is Judy and the program here for the grant that made this quite possible. Another are the nine chapter contributors to this edited volume, whom I won't name here, but I will also mention there's a gender chapter in the book that you will see. And I want to thank all of them for making a very sound volume, I think, and their patience with this project as well. Colette Rausch is one of those contributors. And thank you all for coming here, and I also would like to thank the folks who joined us on the panel. I was just sitting and realizing I met Mike Jadis in 1993 in El Salvador. I met these people in three of the cases when I was doing research, actually. So I met Colette first in Kosovo when I was there with UNDP, and I met Ambassador Klein both in Bosnia and again in Liberia when I was doing some work with the UN. And so thank you all. I just realized that this actually is some closure on some of the input into this volume. What I want to do is very briefly tell you what I hope the volume accomplished, and then give you basically six points that I think are sort of takeaway points from the volume, and tell you a little few little stories, okay? The first thing I'd like to say is there are three things that I really hope that this volume would accomplish, and I think it has accomplished them with more or less success in different cases. And the first of those is we wanted to select some cases that had enough history behind them that we could actually see, not describe what international actors and national level reformers were trying to do in the areas of security reforms and justice reforms, but actually see what impact they made. Like, okay, 4 or 5 or 6 or 10 years down the road, what is there to show for all of the effort that we often read about in the literature, in the gray literature in particular, on police reform and on justice reform and on security sector reform? Let's look at some cases where we have a little bit of history and we can see what happened and what the impact was. And let's try, and I asked all the contributors to try to measure as much as possible the impact of these efforts, okay? The second thing I wanted to do with this volume, which I think we did with relative success, and I think we did with a certain degree of success the first thing, although not as, you know, it's very surprisingly difficult to find standards of measurement that cut across all of these countries, particularly where data and statistics are not available, on crime, on human rights violations, on just judicial efficiency, etc. The second thing we wanted to do was basically really try to look at security reform and the security sector and justice sector as an integrated whole. What UNDP now calls justice and security sector reform. And so that is the entity that we really wanted to do with each of the case studies, look at justice and security sector as an integrated one thing, although it's very difficult to do that, one of the things we found. And part of the difficulty we found is that we found people who are more specialists in one than the other in the contributors, in fact. And the third thing we wanted to accomplish was to really, when we looked at justice, to try to link two very different schools and approaches. And one is the whole group of people who go to conferences on their own, very separate from the other group of people who go to different conferences. And that one, the first one is people who care about justice for the past human rights abuses and atrocities, and the people who work on justice institutional reforms. If you will, justice for the past and justice for the future. And those folks often don't sit together in dialogue. And we really tried to do that in our case studies as well. Again, with some success in some cases and not so much in others. And it's surprisingly difficult to do that, and we can talk about that in Q&A if you will. Okay. The central sort of question of the volume was, what can we learn from cases of relative success in terms of ending wars? Most of these were relative success stories in ending wars. They were not reversion to war outright in the period that we were looking at initially. What can we learn from those cases in terms of building effective, legitimate, and rights-respecting systems of justice and physical security? And here are some of the sort of things that the six points that I want to sort of share with you from this volume that I think, six of the points that I think are important. One of them is that there was a surprising, it's very clear that there are different forms of violence, and that the end of war, that is the end of political violence, often leads to new forms of violence, particularly social violence and economic violence. And so that, people have sort of a political violence framework who look at peace processes, and they fail to see social violence and economic violence. And the international community, in particular, is not very well equipped to anticipate and deploy actors to prevent and reduce social violence and economic violence. By social violence, I'm talking about ethnic violence that may break out that's not related to the political military actors that have that are agreed to a ceasefire. By social violence, I also mean sort of gang violence that has afflicted Central America. By economic violence, I'm talking about profit-motivated violence, such as organized criminal violence, that has afflicted the Balkans in particular. Okay, and then also just common crime. Let me just share with you two in El Salvador. Within 2 years of El Salvador's 1992 ceasefire, homicides tripled and kidnappings increased more than tenfold. Within 2 years of their ceasefire. Robberies quintupled, and common crime, which had been virtually absent in previous opinion polls about what was a big problem in the country, like skyrocketed to the top of the problems. South Africa had a similar experience, as most of you are aware. But the other thing is, when we sat down, the authors, same thing happened in Bosnia and East Timor. You had a rise in certain sort of forms of common crime, and also domestic violence. Also, we have good indications went up in many post-war countries, as research has shown happens. So this point is this, that the international community and oftentimes social violence and economic violence threatens the stability of peace. And so we see that with gang violence, and it certainly threatens the legitimacy of new post-war regimes. So that crime is getting people in Central America in the mid-1990s to a point where they're like, we need to get rid of democracy and bring some hardliners back to run the country, polling data shows, for example. And so intergovernmental organizations and international actors need to basically think about this and anticipate these forms of violence as they confront transitions from war to peace. The second point is that modes of transition are important. And by this, what I mean is modes of transitions to war, not to democracy. Modes of transition to war meaning, is it a negotiated settlement, or is it a victory? Or is it a just petering out? Okay? So basically the three ways that wars end. And I just want to focus on a couple of those. One is the negotiated settlement, and the other is victory, or loss, defeat, depending on which side you're on. And what we found in this study was that for police and justice and reforms, negotiated settlements have certain advantages and disadvantages. The advantage is that the more detailed it is, as Judy mentioned in her introduction, the more of a roadmap you have for implementation of reforms, the more that's part of a peace agreement. And El Salvador here is a good example, which is, you know, you had great detail about the specific dates that security forces would be demobilized, about the numbers that would, of forces that would be downsized. And you even had a draft police law part, an annex to the peace agreement. I mean, that's a level of detail that really helps give a roadmap. Another advantage of it is it gives a good roadmap for implementation, and so that the actors have something to refer to. And it also is good for mobilizing international resources as well. Let me look at different dynamic from victory, for example. 1994 transition in Haiti, the NATO victory in Kosovo, and you can also look at victories in regime change in Afghanistan and Iraq, although those aren't necessarily post-conflict countries, strictly speaking. But some of the dynamics are the same for reconstruction, if you will. But the dynamic is different where you have different advantages and disadvantages. And one of those is you have the supposed advantage of a clean slate. But as Colette points out in her chapter in Kosovo, that clean slate wasn't quite as clean as you like, and that's one of the things that you find in victories is, in fact, all of these processes for international actors, you're dealing with the guts of the state. Police forces and justice systems and security forces are very close to the identity and the nature and what people in those countries care about. And for international actors to engage those issues is a very sensitive and delicate thing. And at the end of the day, domestic elites are always going to be in the driver's seat no matter how important international actors are. Iraq is a good example of that today. Afghanistan as well. So one of the disadvantages of victory transition is you don't have a roadmap. And the other thing is that you don't necessarily have countervailing elites that can put a check on new elites who are empowered by the victory, who want to essentially create security forces or justice systems that empower them and protect their power. This is something we saw with the Aristide government and the Vival government in the 1990s, in Haiti, for example. That was unfortunate. So that's the second point. Victory negotiation leads to certain advantages and disadvantages for external actors. Third point. This has to do with opportunities for transforming both justice systems and security forces. And that is, there's almost always a need to transform these forces, and that involves some sort of purge. So if I were to put this and this is true from the population's perspective almost always, okay, as well as international actors. And that is, there's a need to purge swiftly and to vet thoroughly, but with prudence, okay? So let me give you the example from Bosnia that Michael Doyle, our contributor for the Bosnia case, points out. And he believes that basically elections were held, they were sequenced wrong, so that the elections were held before transformation of state institutions. And that basically empowered nationalist parties who were against the reforms. And so basically shot themselves in the foot in terms of state reforms. So that's one example of where there was not a transformation of the personnel in particular, much less other institutional features. Another example, Guatemala, where the failure to do any significant purging is now seen as contributing to a continued low level of political violence as well as high levels of impunity. I don't know if you just saw a couple of months ago where three Salvadoran parliamentarians were assassinated in Guatemala, and they arrested four cops as suspects in the case, and those four cops, while they were in detention in a prison, were executed, supposedly by the prisoners there. I mean, this is the evidence of the continued problems of impunity and problems within the security forces and a lack of justice. I'm feeling conscious of the time, so I could give you some sort of, one of the things that we come out with is how to do purging and vetting in a sensible way. And I'll just share one of those, which is not too many, not too few. Purging too few forces basically is the problem that Guatemala has confronted that I just described, which is you don't transform the institutional culture of impunity or abuse that might exist and is often associated with wars virtually everywhere. In the north as well as in the south, including Northern Ireland, a case that we should be celebrating today. Not too many, in my view, of course. The purging of Baathists in Iraq, of the military, is a clear example of the problems that you encounter when you basically put a lot of people who are well-networked and trained in use of arms on the street with no job. So, and there are other lessons I can give you, but I'll skip from them, okay? Next point, the importance of public awareness and intense citizen involvement in the reform process if there's any to be any chance of success. And here I go back to Haiti as an example here. Our Haiti case, really our authors there who were a senior official in the OAS human mission, the head of that mission, with one of the authors and a couple of others who worked closely on that, basically felt that in the, sort of looking back on the 1990s, that there was a big mistake of not engaging the population in Haiti more actively in the design, in the implementation, keeping them informed, as well as soliciting their input. And that's a problem of both sort of public mass education and radio, as well as of working with civil society organizations. And let me give you an example. In Haiti, for example, people, when these new cops that the U.S. trained were deployed on the street in 1995, people were like, these are little boys who just, you know, who aren't willing to use the stick, in Creole, they have a saying. And so they're not willing to use a stick, and so what good are these? And so the society basically still had old notions of what effective security forces and justice systems look like that were not touched by the transformation efforts. Another interesting point that comes out in these is what was the role of civil society in each of these cases, and a surprising lack of initiative from civil society organizations, which is a problem and a real challenge, I think, for those of us who would be reformers in post-conflict countries. And we can talk more about that in Q&A if you like. Penultimate point: penultimate institutions should be looked at with an open mind in post-war reforms. Rwanda is one of the cases we have here, and has become virtually everyone is now aware, all my students seem to be, of this thing called Gacaca, which is basically drawing on traditional forms of justice to try genocide suspects in Rwanda. And that is basically the adaptation of an informal institution to handle the challenge of post-war justice. I'm still not sure how effective that has been. But it was adopted, the point I want to make here about this is, it was adopted out of necessity in Rwanda, because neither the national courts nor international tribunals could handle 120,000 genocide suspects, which is actually a significant chunk of the population of Rwanda. And the point is this, is that it's too bad it was out of necessity. It should often be out of looking at informal institutions as alternatives is what international agencies and organizations should do on a much more proactive basis. Now, there are problems with these things that most of you are aware of, but in general, the tendency is for international organizations to be blind to these options and not to pursue them, even critically. The last point I would like to make is about gender. And there's a couple of points that our gender chapter makes that I would just like to highlight. One of them is that I believe, having done a lot of research in these post-conflict societies and then looked at them afterwards, like 5-10 years afterwards, it's actually striking how much a transformation in gender relations, both in societal level and at the level of state institutions, we find. I believe this is one of the things that international actors, without even trying, end up having a window of opportunity. That's what these, basically, war transitions from war create windows of opportunity, not just for state reforms, but also for transforming ideas, and in particular in the area of gender, that may or may not be exploited very adeptly. But it's one that seems to have actually been an important moment in changing gender attitudes and relations in most of these countries. At the same time, most of what international actors do in terms of gender programs in the security reform and justice reform area seems to be highly institutional and not focused on transforming institutional cultures. So one example is that basically you might criminalize marital rape, for example, but not create a unit that can investigate that or is trained to investigate that. You might criminalize domestic violence, but not adequately staff a police unit or a justice system to actually investigate and deal with that, and much less provide engendering opportunities for women in these institutions in ways that can actually sustainably maintain this gender-focused treatment of gender crimes, basically, in these transitional societies. So with that, I'll stop. Thank you very much.
Okay, first of all, I'd like to thank Chuck for the opportunity to even put together the chapter on Kosovo. I was always involved in working in justice and security security aspects from the operational level. And as a practitioner, you get very little opportunities to really put together your thoughts or think about what you're doing sometimes. And so the first day I was here at the Institute, where you're actually paid to think, and that's a good thing, Chuck had come to my office and sent an email and asked if I do this chapter. And although it was painful at times, having to reflect upon what you've done and realizing the mistakes that you even made in your own work, ultimately it was an enjoyable process. Now, I remember driving from Pristina, the capital of Kosovo, in 1999, just a few weeks after KFOR, the NATO forces, had arrived. And at that time, we were driving outside the capital about 20 kilometers through a number of different villages. And we were in an armed vehicle at that time because of the security situation. And obviously, being in that armed vehicle, we were seen as the international community. And what struck me is the number of people who would stop along the way and wave and smile and cheer. And we saw American flags, German flags, French, British flags. We saw these flags painted on buildings. There was even a mural of Madeleine Albright, who at that time was Secretary of State, because she had just arrived a few days ago. And it was interesting, because I think at that point, there was a lot of expectations and jubilance. And from at least the Kosovo Albanian side, we as members of the international community were looked at as liberators at the time. And I remember at one point feeling a lot of pride and hopefulness. But then a thought went through my mind where I thought, unfortunately, I think there's going to come a time, sooner or later, where we will fail everyone here that's waving at us in many respects. And looking back in some of the issues that I raised in the chapter, I find that, unfortunately, in many respects, we did fail Kosovo. And I think, as the Security Council is now going to be debating the future of Kosovo and whether it will be independent, and if so, under what conditions, it's a chance to look back and see where were some of the missed opportunities, or where were there chances that we might have been able to do better, and where were the miscalculations. And I know from firsthand that it's not easy to establish justice and security in countries that are emerging from conflict, and for the reasons that Judy mentioned, as well as Chuck. And so it's not easy, and as humans we often make mistakes. But the hope is that ultimately, that as Judy mentioned, that a lot of the principles that come up, that maybe we could take some of these principles and bring them to other countries, adapted naturally for the circumstances of that country, but not that we're reinventing, I don't want to steal what I think Mike might say, but not reinventing the flat tire. And as I also talk about a few of the reflections from the chapter, I'd like to say that these are ones that I pulled out from the chapter, but also those that over the past 6-7 years since I started in Kosovo still remain true. And these include in countries that I've continued to work in since Kosovo. I think Kosovo has a special place in my heart because of the number of years that I worked in it and how close I've remained to a lot of the people who are still there. But these are reflections that I also have. I'm working in Afghanistan, Liberia, and Nepal, which are countries that I continue to work in. First is that it's important that we understand that security and justice reforms do not happen in a vacuum. It's not a technical type of a process. That it's important that we look, when going in, at the cultural, economic, historical, political factors that are apparent in that country. And also, who are the power players? What are the interests? What were the reasons for the conflict? The single reason, or what are the views that people have on the reasons, because not everybody agrees on those aspects. And that if we don't look at those things, if you look at it just something as simple as, I think what we did in Kosovo is, okay, all we need to do is go in there, train some of the judges on the international standards and get them up to date, and set up a police force, we'll be good to go. And I have to say that really was kind of the vision by many of the people engaged in the early days of Kosovo, and that became quickly apparent as days and weeks and months went on, and it continues to be a challenge, some of the early miscalculations, as they try to now move into the new phase as UN might pull out. And we look at things like the violence against the Serbs that I think took a lot of people by surprise. When we were there, we had Serb judges coming to us saying that they were being evicted from their home forcibly, that they were threatened, and many of them fled the judiciary as soon as they were appointed. As well as setting up the judiciary, it wasn't thought that maybe the judges, the Coast Guard Albanian judges, would not be able to be impartial or adjudicate fairly, either because of biases, which is something that can be expected when you're coming out of a war, and given what had happened to them under the Milosevic regime, and losing 10 years of their autonomy, and also that eventually culminated in ethnic cleansing. So it's difficult to expect them to just wake up on a Monday morning with everything behind them and adjudicate fairly when there are certain served defendants in front of them. Or just the threats to their family, even when there were strong judges who wanted to adjudicate fairly, they were not always given that opportunity because of pressures on their families by some of the former Kosovo Liberation Army actors who even showed up in some of the court proceedings with a uniform and sat in the back of the courtroom. You know, there are many instances of this occurring. So those are things that were not really looked at. And also the underestimation, as Chuck said, of the serious crimes problem. I mean, to be honest, I think had we been savvy, which I think we weren't at the time, we would have seen it. When I was there, you could see people congregating outside the different buildings talking to security guards. What was going on with that? At the gyms that the internationals were working out at, their records were duplicated and given to certain factions. Protection money was paid. All these things were going on, but that didn't get addressed until it got to such a critical mass that, as I'm sure Mike will discuss, it starts to threaten the peace. And political actors who were engaged in organized criminal activity, and the fear that by them engaging in this, how can you have any sort of government that can govern fairly, or a judicial system that can adjudicate fairly, with the pressures they would be getting from organized criminal gangs. And that the trafficking, the activities that were fueling the conflict, didn't just stop overnight, but continued on and impacted the peace development. And also, the second point is the lack of conducting adequate assessments, which relates to the factors I just mentioned, where the political, economic, historical, cultural issues. But also something as simple as when there were training programs, maybe asking the judges and prosecutors what were the things they needed to learn, what was important to them, knowing that there are going to be changes in the laws and they had started to implement them, what parts did they not understand? Instead, no assessment was done. Foreign organizations would come in for a day, just talk about principles, for example, on fair trial and due process rights, with no connection to how you do that in practice. And you see the judges and prosecutors just slowly sitting back with arms crossed, having no idea what these people were talking about and how that related to their work. At the same time, they're being criticized for not applying those exact principles that they have no idea how to implement them in practice. So something as simple as doing a basic needs assessment. Or a traffic law, knowing that there are even existing laws. There was a whole entire traffic law that was drafted, which was very nice. It was based upon, I think, the traffic law in North Carolina or someplace like that. But was it useful? Coast Guard had a traffic law. And maybe if we started with that, it would have been easier. But nobody had a copy of the law. So the first thing we did is set about trying to gather the laws. It was really the military who brought this to the forefront because their view was, we need to follow the law. This is what we base everything on. And then from the civilian standpoint, it was kind of, that's right. We should try to find the law before we start passing new laws. The other challenge was balancing security. I'm going to say balancing security and law and order with justice and rule of law. And what I mean by that, there was this perceived conflict between the two. And at that point, I had come off as just fresh off of being a prosecutor, and to me, I didn't see the difference. Law and order can be done at the same time that you're doing justice, or in different terms, using international human rights standards is not inconsistent with trying to keep a safe and secure environment. And what was interesting is the perceived inconsistency of those two, and that actors in the international community were engaging in conduct that, had they done that in their own country, they would have been violating their country's laws, or had another country done it, and had their State Department or foreign ministries been doing a human rights review, they would have condemned them for that exact activity. And it was just interesting. And finally, with the UN Secretary General's special representative was actually issuing executive detention orders, even after the judiciary released someone, when that judiciary was composed of international judges who had reviewed it, which was a complete violation by all standards. And later that changed, but it was just not a model that wanted to be set. And when we had coming to us military police officers who were willing to try to work to get some of the gangs, yet political expedience overcame their desire to try to work through the paces and do it consistently with the standards and the law. And also the polarization of the community. The polarization when I arrived of OSCE, which was doing human rights monitoring, and the UN, which was implementing, and how there were actors within OSCE who desired more to have kind of sexy headlines as to human rights violations instead of trying to work constructively and pointing out how things can be done. And so there was a division between the two organizations that were supposed to be working together in order to rebuild the justice system in Kosovo, but they were at complete odds, to where I even attended a party and was told I was part of the enemy because I was from an organization that was condemning the UN. And to get underneath it, it was just a matter of personalities and realizing that ultimately, that if each group is not conducting constructive dialogue and trying to come up with solutions, then they weren't getting anywhere. So eventually the reports changed over time, and the people who took over monitoring realized the challenges and started working constructively to point out what the issues were instead of making sweeping statements of indictment that could not then be determined how to implement later on. And the second to last point is following the rules ourselves, maintaining high standards, and setting examples. I mentioned that earlier as far as when we are engaging in executive mission, but also as peacekeepers to make sure that as Prince Zaid, who was the UN ambassador to Jordan's ambassador to UN and now ambassador here, wrote a report about abuses by peacekeepers. And talking to those in Kosovo, that they could, over the years, it's difficult for them to have faith that we're there to do something for the right reason when our own people are violating the rules that we're asking them to follow. And when there's no accountability, everybody understands things happen, but then there's no accountability after all. And then something that's very sensitive, and it's difficult to get at, but how we as the international community come in with kind of a sea of big cars, big bucks, and operate almost as a parallel kind of community, and not engaging with the communities in which we work. And that there's some innovative things. OSCE, when they went to Serbia, they drove little VW Golf so that they would have a lower profile, because they didn't need the big cars. And when we were in Nepal, there were a number of organizations that were using small cars, but others insisted to have the big car presence when you don't need them in that environment. And just to see the look on some of the people's face in Kosovo, in Nepal, where you just look at this, you see all this money that's going to these big cars, running them off the road, when it's not going into the development or they don't see it. And they look at it almost as this kind of experts, the high-paying experts that come in and out. And I think a lot of us are saying, not that you don't need to be paid extra because you're giving up, the comforts of home. That's not what's being said. Not that you shouldn't be paid what you're worth. But there's a point where it becomes excessive, and there's a point where it becomes so in the face of those that we're working with and divides us instead of bringing us together. Lastly, embracing the notion that process matters. And I think this is the place where many of us fell down and continue to fall down. And it's really how we do it is as important than what we technically do. And what I mean by that is it's not ignoring the importance of consultation, partnership, coordination, all the work that we talk about, and participation by those that we're working with, the local actors, the national actors. And something as simple as asking their input and getting a diverse view, not just the people who speak English or talk like we do, but people from wide different groups, because there's not just one public or one local, but finding out from different groups what's needed. And of course, there's inevitable tension between a country that's emerging from conflict and what the international community as a whole or parts may want to accomplish. But that doesn't mean that we come in and know everything and that we could possibly know everything, given the mistakes that we've made. It's evident that we don't, and that by consulting with the actors on the ground, we could maybe prevent a lot of the problems or landmines that we find ourselves in. And I remember giving a Bosnian example, there was someone who said to me, it's like you coming into my house, and you've never been here, you've maybe been here for a few months, when you start telling me how to bake a cake, you tell me everything about baking that cake, but you don't know my altitude here. You don't know the different types of materials that I might be able to do. You don't know the history of how that cake was baked. I'd be more than happy to start with my recipe and listen to some of the ingredients you might want to add to make it better, but don't just throw out my recipe and then start all over with your own recipe as if that's going to work. And that always kind of stuck with me, not to simplify just the insecurity of baking a cake, but just the analogy. And in Kosovo, I saw that with just the number of regulations and regulations that got piled on top of each other, drafted in the middle of the night, and no one was consulted. We had a body that was set up to do it, but usually it was after the fact. And had so many times they were looked at as impediments or obstructionists, but really they were just trying to point out challenges. Instead of seeing them as someone seeing your way, you could have spent 2 days with them, you might have all saved yourself heartache, months and years down the line. And also, lastly, the failure to develop capacity of local actors and handover strategy. I think what's most painful for me with Kosovo is to talk to those right now, today, as a matter of fact, I got emails, who are working in the justice and police areas. And it's almost like I had to shut the email after reading it, not even look at it again, because the same issue that we dealt with 6-7 years ago are coming up again. The lack of a vision, a strategy on how to hand over if the UN pulls out and turns over to the EU, a lack of really developing the local capacity on the police and the justice sector that still hasn't fully happened with the rotating international actors. And so when all is said and done, should Kosovo get the independence, I think of all the different opportunities that we had that we didn't allow to build the capacity in such a way instead of holding it pretty much close to our chest, thinking that they weren't ready in some way. But the only way forward is to start handing it over with oversight, but not just holding it and doling it out. And the last point is, I think that comes up is something that I think we hear more in the realm of doctors. And I think that when all is said and done, the more we do and the more we think we know and you start getting into it, the less you really see that you truly, truly know, and you start looking at everything. So at a minimum, I would say that if I could rely on one thing, it would be, well, I hope that at least we can be humble, and that at a minimum, if we don't know what the heck to do in a situation, at least we don't do something where we do harm. So that's...
First of all, it's a pleasure to see some of the old friends in the audience. And also to realize that there is a vast body of both theoretical and very strong operational knowledge in the audience that we have with us today. The dynamics, dilemmas, and lessons that can be learned and applied, I think, for post-conflict peace building are issues that deserve our serious attention. The fact that you listen, you see the time and the effort and the expense put into these missions, and how much more could have been done as opposed to what was done, is a shame. I think Professor Call deserves great congratulations, obviously. It's a very germane work, and he put together a group of eminent scholars producing the volume that they produced. My notion on all this is, first premise, where does the mandate come from? Is there a template that can be used by everyone? Is there a paradigm, or is it endlessly conflicting organizations? Now, the notion of single organization, single structure, with umbrella responsibility is not new. It was considered years ago, theoretically. In fact, it was drafted, and the organizational structure was relocated in Brussels at the time, but that never materialized. Why it was not acceptable to most of the states in the United Nations. So that when we go back to the basic premise, the primary responsibility for defining these mandates quite often starts with the Security Council. Then the regional players, the OSCE, the EU, and others come in. Now the Security Council, as you know, is very protective of its prerogatives. Financing, obviously, for many of these missions, not only the UN ones, but many others come through the budget system. And the present construct supports not only the traditional peacekeeping missions, also all these other things we mentioned, the political, the electoral, the disarmament missions, identified, et cetera, et cetera. We all understand that sustained and successful nation building requires intense cooperation among governments, the international agencies, the NGOs, and the domestic equation. And that's what the moment is lacking, redundancy, duplication. The success of any attempt to establish justice and security in a post-conflict environment depends on the willingness, first of all, of the international civil military actors to fully integrate their missions, which are always loaded with them. It's a question of theoretical, it's a question of stovepiping. It's also strongly a question of personalities. To what extent is that possible, or do they have separate agendas? Civil and military authorities both tend to justify their own individual efforts. Is the priority humanitarian alleviation of human suffering, or the political engagement to establish democratic structures, judicial, police, etc.? Secondly, is the issue of impartiality. But impartiality has different meanings to politicians, to diplomats, to NGOs, or to the military control. And this stems from the organically different organizational structures that they come from. There's always the fear of encroachment, losing one's influence, which translates time and again into losing one's funding. The military wants minimal insurance by civilians and what they see as their mandate of their operation. Civilians, on the other hand, especially the NGOs and others, have their own priorities. And they want to avoid the perception of taking sides. You want humanitarian distance. You want me to love you and protect you at the same time. And that's not always the easiest thing to do. And the third element is the organizational challenges within ministries, both ministries of foreign affairs, ministries of defense. Each different in terms of what their interests are. Means available. Military wants smallest possible risk, quick resolution, given timeline. Foreign ministries are not only interested in direct results, but obviously the long-term impact this has. And this, coupled with the competition in the NGO world, often has coordination. Makes coordination very difficult but hardly positive. The construct of overlapping responsibilities, not fully defined, compound the problem. And that's the sad part as I read the book. Missed opportunity. No clear definition. Overlapping responsibilities. No clear guidelines. Endless Security Council resolutions. OSCE wagon. EU wagon. All wanting a piece of the turf, piece of the action, and a lot of personality jockeying for positions in the city world. Also, some of the actors stress secrecy, which clashes directly with the need for cooperation and transparency. The body of evidence from past efforts to come to grips with these issues argues obviously, and I've seen quite a bit of literature in the past year or two, on holistic approach. What does that mean? Essentially means that specific post-conflict programs cannot work in isolation. The courts, prisons, police must be established together, work together. Have as comprehensive a mandate as can be arrived at, because sustained and successful nation building, as the authors envision, requires intense cooperation among governments, the international agencies, and domestic groups. So we come back to the basic premise. That's the old adage, if you start out and you don't know where you're going, you're probably going to wind up somewhere else. And this has consistently been the dilemma, because if you understand the nature of a crisis, what happens in a crisis? There is a problem in the world somewhere which no one quite knows how to deal with, bilaterally, trilaterally. So we give it to the Security Council. Now, what is the Security Council? 15 nations. The authority, however, lies with the General Assembly. The General Assembly, 192 nations, have the plenipotentiary power to declare war on peace. They know they can't do that. So they turn it over to the Council. The Council has 5 permanent members, UK, France, China, Russia, and the United States, and 10 rotating. Now, the first thing that happens, and when you look at the egregious wrongs, Rwanda and other things, the first thing that happens in the council is, he will say to his assistant, in that part of the world, do we have anything insured? Is there anything of value to us? And the answer is no, well, we don't give that. Someone else says, look, there is a crisis, we should do something. We should engage. The people deserve it. And then they start arguing. Now, let's take the assumption that we're talking about a fire burning. Simple now. And someone says, all right, what do we need to do this? 2 fire trucks, 2 pumpers, 1 ladder truck, 250 fire. And we agree on it. Well, it's too many, it costs too much, etc., etc., etc. So after two or three days of negotiation, argumentation, etc., they finally decide, yes, the Security Council will authorize a mandate to put out the fire. And they're authorized two fire trucks, two pumper trucks, one ladder truck, 250 miles. And then they give the Secretary General a piece of paper that says, you have a mandate to go out there and put out that fire. With the two fire trucks, the ladder truck, and 250 miles. And Coffey Nancy looks at this and says, well, where do I get this? Well, Mr. Secretary General, that is your job. So what happens, basically, is you have an office for the Rolodex. And they start calling people. Do you have a fire truck that you can give us? Peru says yes. We have a 1942 Mack truck, which we're getting rid of because Wurzburg, Germany is giving us the Rolodex. Now I have one. The Danes are nice. They come through with the truck. And the Canadians give you the ladder truck, which unfortunately goes up four stories. So now I have my two fire trucks. One, by the way, one is diesel and one is gasoline. And the hoses are not interoperable. The 250 firemen do not speak each other's mind. And then we start arguing about who will be the fire chief. I will support this mandate if my man is the fire chief. In fact, my man turns out to be the president of the election. So now we have, my company has to find the money, the fire trucks, the ladder trucks, and then you go out and do something. Then once you're out there, other people want to play. Well, we in the OSC, you know how to put out fire. We in the EU are specialists now in putting out fires. And suddenly you have enormous competition, and then the NGOs want to be there. That's the nature of a mandate, and I'm not joking, because your mandate defines what you can and cannot do. I've got chapter 5, I've got chapter 6.5, and in Liberia, chapter 7. Chapter 7 means I'm not only there to protect myself, I'm there to protect him, and deal with anyone who tries to threaten. Chapter 6.5 is I'm here to protect myself. If I can get away with it, I'll protect the locals. Chapter 5 says I watch. Now, how can we look back now, looking back on, as we're sitting here, intellectualizing on this? We have Darfur going on now. Not today. People are being killed as we sit here. Right? But who the hell is doing it? Newspaper ads, articles, well-meaning intellectuals, politicians, whether it be visible. But who's going to do something? Where's the mandate that says you have 10,000 troops trained and armed? X number of helicopter gunships, because these people are pickup trucks on campus. Deal with it, stop it. You're not changing the government of Sudan. You're not destabilizing anything. You're creating a safe, secure environment so people stop being killed. And until those kinds of issues, Darfur, are dealt with realistically now, much of what we're doing is what the Germans call Wahnsinn. Down the track. Much of it. So that's your dilemma. Regionally, Bosnia, Croatia, Kosovo. What structure do you have? We have I-4, UNMIP, OSCE. And the UN agencies are not necessarily disciplined anymore. We have a construct called the Integrated Mission. When I tried that in Liberia, the question was, where did this come from? Because I think the Secretary General wants it done. We have no such organization. We're a stovepipe. We have a separate personnel system, a separate communication system, and a separate funding line. And the best thing you can say is you have like a squirrel in a cage full of nuts trying to control something. To say nothing of the NGOs, because you don't know how they got there. Who brought them into the country? What is your métier, as we say in French? What do you do here? Because in Liberia, we had five Médecins Sans Frontières. Five. Holland, Belgium, France, Spain, Switzerland. Why do I need five Médecins Sans Frontières competing with each other for disability programs? But there's no controls on those kinds of things. There's no structure. I've come to the point where I think in mandates, what I need are two mandates. My first mandate is to go in and stop the killing. Do this. Because diplomacy is negotiation, turn the other cheek, find common ground, at times swallow hard, and take it. But then you're going to meet the psychopath and the pathological killer. And that's when you need to do surgery. And you need to do surgery quickly, cleanly, and well. To stop kind of nerve tissue muscle damage and patient working. If you argue, who's the anesthesiologist? When are we going to do the surgery? Where are we going to do the surgery? Whose surgical instruments are we going to use? People die. As they not only did in Rwanda, but they're dying in Darfur now. So what I still find lacking in all of this is a kind of clear structure when we go somewhere, whether it's to Kosovo or Bosnia. Bosnia had hundreds of UN resolutions, multiplicity of international organizations, probably over 400 NGOs. Now, how do you get your hands on that? And that's why what you said is so meaningful. In other words, the redundancy, the repetition, the waste. And as soon as a new mission comes in, let's assume our colleague here did the policing, and I won't name the organization he worked for, but he leaves and a new policing mission comes in. Actually, everything he did was totally flawed, a waste of time, and unstructured, and we're surprised that he even bothered, because we're here now, and we start all over again. And the first thing we're going to argue about is what? Should we drive Volkswagens or Renaults? This is a big tension in the mission. Whether it's going to be a French vehicle or a German one. That was a major issue on the first few weeks. Those kinds of things. Why are your policemen paid three times what my policemen are paid? Coming out of Spain or somewhere else. And those are the kinds of things that tear you apart, that there's no real centralized structure mandate that everyone understands. They say nothing to them, as I said, the first time. This is useful because it gives us an idea of what's been done and where it's been done, and hopefully that we can develop somewhere some paradigm, some template, some basic things, a DDR package where we've done it now in Angola and Mozambique and in Liberia and Croatia. How do you do DDR? Is there some way that we can now do this and understand that? Is there monetary consideration for turning weapons? What is it? What does it take? And that's what I would hope would come out of some dialogue like this, that over time you'd have more or less of a very decent handle for international crises. Lessons learned, things that you can really use, things that obviously did not work, but hopefully we would do a better job than we have up to now. But I stand here feeling rather silly in a way, as people in Darfur are being murdered, and we're all intellectually arguing and debating and speculating how I could or could not be done.
I'm finding it very easy to police this panel because everybody's sticking to their time.
Thank you very much. Rule of law is prevailing today. It's a privilege to be a part of this discussion. As Chuck mentioned, we met in El Salvador back in 1993. He's done a tremendous amount of reflection on what has taken place there and many other cases to provide us with an ample set of lessons that, if applied, would take the qualified yes that Chuck has given us. Can the international community effectively bring justice and security to societies struggling to emerge from conflict? He says yes, but. But what? Listen to the lessons that he provided us. And I'm just going to talk about two very briefly. But I think if all of them were applied, the answer might become a much more unqualified yes, we can. Let's stop reinventing the flat tire and start applying the lessons. I just want to talk about two. He talked about the culture of abuse and impunity. And in the book, he mentions that peace is often accompanied by a continuation of violent conflict. One of the ways that I've phrased it, or paraphrasing Clausewitz, is that peace is but the continuation of conflict by other violent means. Why is that? Justice and security reform take place in a context, as he says, in a political, economic, cultural context that is not supportive of rule of law. Who is it who wins and who loses if the peace process prevails? The losers are people who attain power through violence. And they conflict pays. Typically, they are profiting from conflict, whether it's arms smuggling, black marketeering, trafficking in humans, access to all kinds of illicit criminal wealth. Those people are going to lose if the peace process flourishes. So the first lesson is that we, the international community, have to understand that context, shape that environment, so that the institutions that we're trying to develop, these embryonic, nascent, weak institutions, have a chance for success. So that's one of the first lessons. Is, can this be done? He cites how long it has taken us. I'll quote, it took decades, maybe centuries, to develop institutional legitimacy, to supplant loyalties to individual princes and lords. Let's think about the challenge we have today. How long do we have to supplant the loyalties of illicit power structures and warlords in these situations? First of all, we have to recognize the problem. We have structures by people like Milosevic, who are state officers, or Charles Taylor, or the warlords and drug lords in Afghanistan. And if those are not dealt with, the institutions that we're working to try to create and function are they going to be captured by those illicit elements? So the result is not a rule of law, we've just reinvented the flat tire. So we have to bring robust military and policing capability together in our intervention forces. I talk about doing things like intelligence-led operations. Is this possible? Have we even seen this? One of the great unsung successes in Kosovo, right under our noses after we intervened, there was a power struggle raging, not between Albanians and Serbs, yes, that Serbs were being killed, but the KLA was engaging in a power struggle against the LDK and Vukovic forces, and they were assassinating and moving in on all of their elements in the municipalities. Celebrated cases, Daoud Hardina, you may recognize the name of Ramush's brother, one of the KLA warlords, a week after the bombing ceased, had his henchmen assassinate four of Rubel's bodyguards. You may remember Rubel was not eager to return to Kosovo for about 6 months. We had to get him back just to kind of get the peace process moving forward. That case was handled by international judges and prosecutors. Daoud Hardina is now in jail. Witnesses actually came forward to testify against him and getting convicted. Five of them have now met violent deaths, so I would not say that there's a context yet in Kosovo that's capable of sustaining the rule of law, but at least we've begun to address those kinds of what I call illicit power structure. Chuck makes a very important point about justice and security sector reform. We always overlook intelligence sector reform. One of the other leading criminals, if you will, in Kosovo was Remy Mustafa. He was in charge of the intelligence apparatus of the KLA called the K-Sheik. And he was basically an organized criminal. He is now in jail as well. So, shaping the environment. Can we do it? Is this an isolated instance? It's begun to happen in Haiti. And if you're following what's going on in Cité Soleil, when the UN and the force commander, backed up by robust policing capability and the foreign police units, decided to go in and start retaking block by block Cité Soleil from the gangs, they're succeeding. They can't do it alone. There's a lot of other things that will have to be done to sustain that. But the UN can do it. And what's going on in the Ituris and the Kivus in Eastern Congo as well is an attempt to sever the nexus between illicit wealth and the rape of the natural resources of Congo, which really is fueling the conflict, and the guerrilla and rebel forces and government that were responsible for exploiting that. So the UN is playing a decisive role there. They can do it. It's not an impossible task. So that's lesson number one. We need to become proficient in shaping the environment. But then Chuck asked, can those reforms be sustained? And he properly accentuates the role of civil society. But here's the problem. Even if we shape the environment, we take a holistic approach to institutional development, police, judiciary, prosecutors, human management, et cetera, the legal code. How long does that take? It's not an instant process. 5 to 10 years. Proficient, maybe 5 years, and that's probably the minimum amount of time. How long does it take to develop a civil society so that it's sufficient to serve as a check on state power, to prevent the politicization of those security forces? That doesn't happen in 5 to 10 years. That's maybe in Germany, if you recall, you know, the study of civic culture, Allman and Berger were surprised to find out when they studied in 1956 that Germany was a democracy, but it didn't have a civic culture. But they went back 15 years later and said, something's happened. The culture has changed. It took about 20 or 30 years for a culture that was capable of sustaining democracy, if you will, to emerge. There was a sort of cocoon there developed around Germany after World War II that allowed their institutions to develop. Well, we need to figure out how to develop, to provide that same sort of cocoon. Exit strategies are followed. Haiti should have shown us that in 81, if you will, when we left Haiti after the initial venture there. But certainly East Timor has made the case. That conflict was resolved, yet by turning ownership over to the locals, what happened was the security apparatus was politicized. So what can we do? We need to become proficient at putting, embedding safeguards into those institutions. Yes, turn ownership over to the locals. But the question is, which locals? Not the ones who were originally responsible for the conflict. Not the ones who benefit from the use of political violence and who derive wealth and access to underground economic activity as even a source of power. Not those individuals. But they are the ones who will likely rise up and take over and take charge. If we exit, we have to remain engaged. We need to transition. We need to create regimes that are capable of nurturing the process so that this is really what Chuck was talking about. After the war ends, have we created a situation where justice and security can prevail? And so I think that's those two areas, shaping the environment and embedding proper safeguards to assist the transition and keep the process going forward, are vitally important lessons. So thank you very much, Chuck, for what you've done for us. And I think if we do heed them, the answer to your question will be, yes, we can do this.
Well, thank you very much.